This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Down to Business. My name is Jeff, and I'm recording this episode from the Mind's Eye studio just outside St. Louis in Belleville, Illinois. In today's episode, we'll explore a variety of stories from some of my favorite business publications, including Fast Company, Fortune, Forbes, and the Wall Street Journal. So settle in. It's time to get down to business. Our first article this week does come from the Wall Street Journal called American Consumers Are Getting Thrifty Again. Generic brands and bulk buying are on the rise and fewer fancy burritos are being sold. The what-the-heck purchase is completely gone. Americans are back on the hunt for a good deal. Consumer spending stagnated in the first half of this year, according to federal data issued last week, and the CEO of Chipotle Mexican Grill, Kroger, and Procter & Gamble, among others, are telling investors that their customers are more strapped or appear to feel that way. "There's a lot of consumer anxiety," said Dirk Van de Put, the chief executive of Mondelez International, which makes Oreo cookies, Ritz crackers, and Cadbury chocolate. Global sales of snacks rose last quarter, but U.S. sales fell a lot. After spending lavishly throughout the post-pandemic years on everything from home improvement to travel, U.S. consumers find themselves in a summer of economic uncertainty. Beef prices are the highest on record. Daily latte habits now face as much as an additional 50% tariff on coffee. Ford Motor, which makes the most popular vehicle in the U.S., the F-150 truck, said the Trump administration's flurry of trade deals have helped a punishing level of duties on the automaker. It has already raised prices on some cars and trucks to help cover the additional cost. Shoppers who are wary about inflation, job expectations, and their personal finances are dialing down their spending to focus on essentials and forego the extras, executives said. The company behind Invisalign said patients are putting off orthodontic treatment and choosing metal braces over pricier clear alternatives. P&G, which sells daily use items such as Tide, Charmin, and Pantene, said it's noticing signs of slower spending across essential products as well. Consumers on both ends of the spectrum, low income and higher income, are reacting to the current volatility they are experiencing. P&G CFO Andre Schulman said, "We see consumption trends consistently decelerating," he said. Even though people still need to do laundry, wash their hair, and put diapers on their babies, Americans are using up the goods in their pantry and seeking value by buying it in bulk to economize or purchasing smaller packs to spend less. This new behavior is driven by worries about the future, whether over-imagining policies, inflation, or how tariffs will filter down to consumers, said P&G's chief executive John Moeller. "People are frustrated, and I would say understandably frustrated with the lack of certainty," he told investors. Kevin Irvin Kelly, an architect who lives in L.A., says his family has made budget cuts at every level. "Gone are date nights with his wife where they easily spent $150 on dinner. Instead of vacationing at a resort in Hawaii or Mexico, this year they're visiting in-laws with their 7-year-old daughter." The couple has maintained their incomes, Kelly says, but swings in retirement funds and questions about how tariffs could push up prices have given them pause. "This time feels different," he said. "You hunker down and wait it out." The Kellys still indulge a few of their daughter's requests, but not all. She recently got a hard no to her wish for a new Smurfs backpack, Kelly said. She can keep using her Wicked theme bag from last year, he added. He also noticed that at children's birthday parties, there's a new parent suggestion: no gifts necessary. "The what-the-heck purchase is completely gone," Kelly says. "We're only doing things that are known quantities that will get the job done." At Kroger, shoppers are making more trips to the store but putting less in their carts. They're also clipping coupons again and scrimping on discretionary items such as alcohol. The biggest supermarket chain in the U.S. is selling more generic brand products and offering promotions to entice customers to keep coming back, even as receipts per shopping cart shrink. "What we're seeing is different shopping behaviors," Kroger CEO Ron Sargent said. "Customers are looking for value. Families who dine out are trading down for cheaper options, too. fast casual chain Olive Garden is getting more business from households with annual incomes over $150,000, while those who earn less than $50,000 are showing up less. Sales at burrito chain Chipotle, where a build-your-own bowl can cost $10 to $16, were down last quarter, while Domino's Pizza reeled in more diners with its two-for-one deal and other promotions. Americans now spend nearly 4 hours a day thinking about money, making it the equivalent of a part-time job, according to a June survey by Empower, the 401k giant. More than half of the 2,200 adults surveyed said that they are thinking about money more often than they did last year. Chelsea Hollins, 26-year-old, and her boyfriend usually fly off for a vacation each year. This summer, they opted for a cheaper camping trip. Even Walmart's prices seem to be going up, and Hollins has to stretch her hard-earned dollars as a full-time college student and part-time paid intern at the Detroit Institute of Arts. She goes to multiple stores to find staples, hunting for the lowest prices. Aldi, she says, has the best deals on meat. She also canceled her DoorDash subscription and downloaded the coupon apps for Dollar General and Walgreens so she can compare promotions. "I was not doing couponing before," Holland says. "I'm getting into it because you have to do that now." Amanda Verdino used the Rocket Money app to analyze her recurring subscription costs. The 39-year-old marketing director at employee benefits company Forma downgraded her Ancestry.com account to save $20 a month and canceled most of her subscribe and save orders from Amazon.com when she realized she already had items on the list stockpiled. "We really looked at what we can trim, she said. "If you go into our garage, you'll see a stack of a zillion paper towels and a zillion rolls of toilet paper, and under every sink is at least one or two packets of toothpaste. I thought, why are we just blindly paying for more of this stuff?" A May poll of consumer sentiment conducted by consulting firm McKinsey found most people plan to adjust their spending in response to tariffs. Rising prices was the top concern of those surveyed, far outweighing issues such as immigration, international conflict, and political polarization. Kiera Karnowski, who's 31, is expecting her second child later this month and has worked hard to take her expenses down by a range of 60 to 70%. From her weekly grocery bill to luxury skincare products, she has been ruthless, she says. If it's not necessary, it's no longer purchased. A few weeks ago, she found herself racked with guilt after splurging on $5 coffee. "That expense is nothing compared to her former guilty pleasure of perusing the aisles at TJ Maxx and Home Goods. Back then, I was like, life is short, treat yourself," she said. Now she's keenly aware of how much is on the line for her family's finances. "I really believe that the American economy has a massive math problem. Everything is getting more expensive, but wages have not." Our next article comes from Grist magazine, and it's called "Climate Disasters Are Killing Small Businesses." The United States is home to millions of small businesses that form the backbone of countless communities. Even during the best of times, keeping shops solvent can be a struggle. But when climate-driven disasters strike, the impact on mom and pop can be particularly devastating and prolonged. "The news coverage has definitely focused on the physical destruction," said Kyle McCurry. He's the director of public relations for Explore Asheville, an organization that promotes the North Carolina city, which Hurricane Helene pummeled with torrential rain and flooding last fall. "But sometimes what's less visible is the economic impact on small businesses in the community over time. Whether it's hurricanes, wildfires, heat waves, or ice storms, small businesses are more vulnerable to climate shocks than larger businesses," said Scheer, the senior research associate at the Aspen Institute of Financial Security Program. He co-wrote a recent report outlining the hurdles small businesses face from severe weather. "They can be hobbled by a range of challenges, from limited preparation resources to lack of post-disaster financing. One reason we focused on small businesses here is because of the importance to the U.S. economy," says Nabi. "That was certainly the case in Asheville, a city known for its artists, breweries, and boutiques. Helene not only destroyed homes and upended lives, it sent the region's economy into a tailspin." In 2023, McCurry said visitors to the area spent $2.9 billion. Last year, Helene hit Appalachia right before the busy fall foliage season when tourists flocked to places like Asheville to see the leaves turn. McMurray says the storm, which knocked out some municipal services for weeks, led to 20 to 40% drop in annual business revenue. 10 months later, a slew of businesses haven't reopened. Vivian's Restaurant, Pleb Urban Winery, and TRVE Brewery, to name a few. Another was New Origin Brewery, which started pouring in 2021 and soon had fans lauding their business. Although the floodwaters inundated the facility, the bulk of the destruction occurred when railroad cars floated off nearby tracks and crashed into the building. "There's not a way to get money for damages in that scenario," said Dan Junkie, one of New Origin's founders. "Even after maxing out the brewery's flood insurance claim, it wasn't enough to cover the damage. The only other option was to take on more debt from the Federal Small Business Administration, or SBA, which didn't seem prudent." Ultimately, Junkie and his business partners decided to apply for a Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA-funded buyout program, that purchases flood-damaged property and limits rebuilding as a way to mitigate the damage from future storms. "We signed up for it and have been waiting almost a year now," he said. McCurry estimates that overall, around 85% of Asheville businesses have reopened in some form, which is relatively good news. According to 2014 national data from FEMA and the U.S. Department of Labor, 40% of small businesses do not reopen after a natural disaster, and another 25% shutter within a year. These waves of impacts are coupled with limited support options for small businesses in both the long and the short term. While FEMA has individual and public assistance programs, there's little of any funding for businesses. The SBA often offers low-interest loans, but the paperwork can be burdensome and the money might not start arriving for months. Only 14% of businesses were able to rely on support from the federal government, according to an analysis of the 2021 Small Business Credit Survey conducted by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. "Support makes a meaningful difference," says Nobby. "For a lot of businesses, it's the difference between closing down and surviving, but it doesn't reach all the businesses that could benefit." State and local governments, private lenders, and community fundraising are other potential sources of money. New Origin, for example, raised more than $100,000 via a GoFundMe campaign, but fell short of its $300,000 goal. The fund that Explore Asheville established has brought in $2.1 million, which has been awarded to more than 500 businesses. Still, Nabby says these avenues don't usually address one of the toughest challenges facing business over a short term, liquidity. Even a month or two after disrupted cash flow can devastate some operations, which is why experts point to pre-disaster planning as one of the most effective steps a business can take to help protect itself. "Often businesses see contingency planning as a distraction from the core thing they want to do," says Benjamin Collier, an associate professor in the Department of Risk and Insurance at the Wisconsin School of Business. "But things like better understanding your insurance coverage or where to move inventory in the event of a threat should be routine steps for business owners and generally aren't expensive." The natural tendency for many small business owners to be reluctant to really engage with the risk that they're exposed to, he said. "This is a call to have more buffers and be more cautious." Nobby also underlines the importance of planning, but says structural change could help as well. Greater use of parametric insurance, which automatically pays out when a specific event like a disaster happens, would allow quicker access to funds. Shifting more money to pre-disaster preparation could help businesses avoid the worst impacts of a storm, too. The financing and preparation is limited compared to what's available post-disaster. Pat Nye is the regional director for the LA Small Business Development Network. Early this year, the counties he oversees saw historically devastating wildfires, and one thing that he's noticed was that, unlike other residential properties, insurance companies hadn't offered small business discounts for any improvements they might have made to their building to be more fire resilient. "As it stands, there's no incentive that exists for this work," says Nye. "A lot of stuff just focuses on homeowners. Governments often don't do enough to include small businesses in their recovery plans either," contends Kristen Farinakis, Associate Director of Small Business Policy and Innovation at the nonprofit Milliken Institute. She pointed to a landscaper in the Asheville area who spent weeks helping clear debris after Helene without pay and ended up facing eviction. "Those are the kinds of businesses," she said, "that municipalities should be hiring and including in rebuilding efforts." More broadly, a report Farinakis wrote called for a cross-agency small business resilience czar, standardized disaster assistance forms, and quicker grant dispersal, among other recommendations. She called the current system very reactionary and argues for increased attention to not just the immediate impacts of disasters, but the long-term economic fallout as well. When we think about fortifying small businesses, she said, it's about going beyond a physical structure. Our next article can be found at the New York Times. Trump fired America's economic data collector. History shows the perils. Economists say unbiased data is essential for policymaking and for democracy. When President Trump didn't like the weak jobs numbers that were released on Friday, he fired the person responsible for producing them. It was a move with few precedents in the century-long history of economic statistics in the United States, and for good reason. When political leaders meddle in government data, it rarely ends well. There is the case of Greece, where the government faked deficit numbers for years, contributing to a debilitating debt crisis that required multiple rounds of bailouts. The country then criminally prosecuted the head of the statistical agency when he insisted on reporting the true figures, further eroding the country's international standing. There is the case of China, where earlier this century, the local authorities manipulated data to hit growth targets mandated by Beijing, forcing analysts and policymakers to turn to alternative measures to gauge the state of the country's economy. Perhaps most famously, there's the case of Argentina, which in the 2000s and 2010s systematically understated inflation figures to such a degree that the international community eventually stopped relying on the government's data. That loss of faith drove up the country's borrowing cost, worsening a debt crisis that ultimately led to it defaulting on its international obligations. It's too soon to know whether the United States is on a similar path, but economists and other experts said that Mr. Trump's decision on Friday to fire Erica McEffner, the Senate-confirmed head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, was a troubling step in that direction. Janet Yellen, the former Treasury Secretary and chair of the Federal Reserve, said the firing was not what is expected from the most advanced economy in the world. This is the kind of thing you would expect to see in a banana republic, Mrs. Yellen says. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is officially part of the Labor Department, whose secretary is a member of the president's cabinet. But the agency operates independently, producing detailed and nonpartisan data on employment prices, wages, and other topics. Economists say that reliable, independently produced statistics are critical to good decision-making in both the public and private sector. Officials at the Federal Reserve rely on government-collected data on inflation and employment to decide how to set interest rates, which affect how much Americans must pay to get a mortgage or a car loan. Good data helps not just the Fed, it helps the government, but it also helps the private sector, Jerome Powell, the Fed chair, said at a recent news conference. The United States has been a leader in that for 100 years, he added, and we really need to continue that, in my view. Experts on government statistics say data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics and other agencies is unlikely to deteriorate dramatically overnight. The acting commissioner named to replace Dr. McEntantifer was a temporary basis. William Witrowski is a longtime employee of the agency who is widely respected by experts both inside and outside government. The career employees who collect and analyze the data remain in place using the same methods and procedures they used before Dr. McAndifer was pushed out. But efforts who just days ago defending the integrity of the statistical agencies now find themselves asking uncomfortable questions about the trajectory of economic data in the U.S. If the poverty numbers come in and look great, is the director of the census going to get a raise? Said Amy O'Hara, a former Census Bureau official who is now a professor at Georgetown University. If the household income numbers don't look great, what happens then? What about GDP? What about CPI? Andreas Giorgio knows the challenges of standing up to such political pressure. After he took over Greece's statistical agency in 2010, he found that the country had been severely understating its budget deficits. Those findings ran afoul of the Greek authorities, who spent years trying to prosecute him on a variety of charges related to his work, despite independent reviews that supported his conclusions. He fared better, though, on Olympi Kevning, the Soviet census official who was arrested and executed when his population count came in lower than Joseph Stalin had announced. Mr. Giorgio refused to bend. Reliable statistics are important for policymaking, he said, but they are also essential to democracy. Official statistics, government statistics, are a mirror of the society holds up to itself, he said. If that mirror is distorted or broken entirely, then the accountability that is central to a democratic system cannot work. If society cannot see itself clearly, then it cannot identify its problems, he said. It cannot identify its problems, then it cannot find the right solutions. And if it can't find the right persons to solve those problems. Mr. Trump said he fired Dr. McAntifer because her numbers produced by the agency were rigged to hurt him politically. Experts on the government statistics, including former commissioners in both Democratic and Republican administrations, have called foul on that accusation. The commissioner, who is the Bureau's sole political appointee, does not control the numbers that the agency publishes or even see them until they have been finalized by a staff of career technocrats whose careers typically span multiple presidential administrations. Erica Groshen, who led the Bureau under President Barack Obama, recalled getting resistance from the agency's staff when she tried to liven up the language of the monthly job reports. The Bureau staff insisted that the agency's job wasn't to say whether the glass was half full or half empty, only to report that it's an 8-ounce container with 4 ounces of liquid, Mrs. Groshen relented. That is not to say political interference would be impossible. Government statistics rely on hundreds of methodical decisions, many of them judgment calls, with no obviously correct answer. A sufficiently sophisticated agency head might, over time, be able to nudge the data in a politically advantageous direction without any single decision being so egregious that it led to mass resignation of career employees. I could imagine a new commissioner coming in and trying to make changes to these methods and procedures that try to move the numbers one way or the other, said Catherine G. Abram, who led the Bureau during the Clinton and Bush administrations. They would have to know a lot in terms of where to put the finger on the scale, though. There are also blunter approaches. In Argentina in 2007, the government of then-President Néstor Kirchner pushed out the mathematician in charge of the country's consumer price data, then released an inflation figure that was dramatically lower than the one the mathematician had calculated. The public wasn't fooled, nor were the international bond investors who ultimately turned to alternative sources of inflation data calculated by researchers outside the government. Private alternatives can complement official statistics, but they are not a substitute. Mr. Cavallo wrote in an email, government agencies have the resources and scale to conduct nationwide surveys, something that no private initiative can fully replicate. Recently, Mr. Cavallo has been publishing data on consumer prices in the United States, which has shown the impact of Mr. Trump's tariffs more quickly than the government data. But while such real-time sources are valuable, they don't carry the institutional credibility of the government. The trouble is that once that credibility has eroded, it's hard to repair, particularly at a time when partisans on both sides of the political aisle are skeptical of numbers they put out by the opposing party. Nancy Potok, the former census official who served as chief statistician of the United States during the first Trump administration, said that in the past there had been strong bipartisan support for the statistical system in Congress and the business community. But partisanship seems to have eroded that support at a moment when the combination of political pressure and longstanding budget challenges are making it most necessary. There were some people who really understood the value of economic data, and now that's not in the conversation, and those champions aren't there like they were in the past, she said. There's no one leading the charge or the change to make these kinds of investments. Our next article this week comes from The Atlantic, and the title is The Mystery of the Strong Economy Has Finally Been Solved. The Trump economy doesn't look so hot after all. This morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released revised data showing that over the past 3 months, the U.S. labor market experienced its worst quarter since 2010, other than during the first year of the coronavirus pandemic. The timing was awkward. Hours earlier, President Donald Trump had announced a huge new slate of tariffs set to take effect next week. He'd been emboldened by the fact that the economy had remained strong until now, despite economists' warnings, a fact that turned out not to be a fact at all. After Trump announced his first sweeping round of Liberation Day tariffs in April, the country appeared to be on the verge of economic catastrophe. The stock market plunged, the bond market nearly melted down, and expectations of future inflation skyrocketed, and experts predicted a recession. But the crisis never came. Trump walked back or delayed his most extreme threats and those that he didn't seem to inflict much economic damage. Month after month, economists predicted that evidence of the negative impact of tariffs in the economic data was just around the corner. Instead, according to the available numbers, inflation remained stable, job growth remained strong, and the stock market set new records. The Trump administration took the opportunity to run a victory lap. Lots of folks predicted that it would end the world, that there would be some sort of disastrous outcome, Stephen Murren, the chair of Trump's Council of Economic Advisors, said. And once again, the tariff revenue is pouring in. There's no sign of any economically significant inflation whatsoever, and job creation remains healthy. A July 9th White House press release declared President Trump was right again, touting strong job numbers and mild inflation. President Trump is overseeing another economic boom, it concluded. The seemingly strong data spurred soul-searching among journalists and economists. The economy seems healthy. Were the warnings about tariffs overblown? Read a representative New York Times headline. Commentators scrambled to explain how the experts could have gotten things so wrong. Maybe it was because companies had stocked up on imported goods before the tariffs had come into effect. Maybe the economy was simply so strong that it was impervious to Trump's machinations. Maybe economists were suffering from tariff derangement syndrome. Either way, the possibility that Trump had been right and the economists wrong had to be taken seriously. The sky's refusal to fall likely influenced the Trump administration's decision to press ahead with more tariffs. In recent months, Trump has imposed 25% tariffs on car parts and 50% tariffs on copper, steel, and aluminum. He has threatened 200% tariffs on pharmaceuticals. Over the past week, Trump announced trade deals under which the European Union, Japan, and South Korea agreed to accept a 15% tariff on exports to the U.S. Finally, this morning, he announced a sweeping set of new tariffs, a sort of Liberation Day redo, including a 39% levy on Switzerland, 25% on India, and 20% on Vietnam. These are scheduled to take effect on August 7th unless those countries can negotiate a deal. Then came the new economic data. This morning, the BLS released its monthly jobs report showing that the economy added just 73,000 new jobs last month, well below the 104,000 that forecasters had expected, and that employment rose slightly to 4.2%. More important, the new report showed that job numbers for the previous 2 months had been revised down considerably after the agency received a more complete set of responses from the businesses it surveys on a monthly basis. What had been reported as a strong 2-month gain of 291,000 jobs was revised down to a paltry 33,000. What had once looked like a massive jobs boom ended up being a historically weak quarter of growth. Even that might be too rosy a picture. All the net gains over the past 3 months came from a single sector, healthcare, without which the labor market would have lost nearly 100,000 jobs. That's concerning because healthcare is one of the few sectors that it is mostly insulated from broader economic conditions. People always need it, even during bad times. The manufacturing sector, which tariffs are supposed to be boosting, has shed jobs for 3 months straight now. Moreover, the new numbers followed an inflation report released by the Commerce Department yesterday that found that the Federal Reserve's preferred measure of price growth had picked up in June and remained well above the central bank's 2% target. The prior month's inflation report was also revised upward to show a slight increase in May. Economic growth and consumer spending also turned out to have fallen considerably compared with the first half of 2024. Taken together, these economic reports are consistent with the stagflationary environment that economists were predicting a few months ago: mediocre growth, a weakening labor market, and raising prices. The striking thing about these trends is how heavily they diverge from how the economy was projected to perform before Trump took office. As the economist Jason Furman recently pointed out, the actual economic growth rate in the first 6 months of 25 was barely more than half of what the Bureau of Economic Analysis had projected in November of 24, while core inflation came in about a third higher than those projections. The worst might be yet to come. Many companies did, in fact, stock up on imported goods before the tariffs kicked in. Others have been eating the cost of tariffs to avoid raising prices in the hopes that the duties would soon go away. Now that tariffs seem to be here to stay, more and more companies will likely be forced to either raise prices or slash their costs, including labor costs. A return to the 1970s-style combination of rising inflation and unemployment is looking a lot more likely. The Trump administration has found itself caught between deflecting blame for the weak economic numbers and denying the numbers' validity. In an interview with CNN this morning, Merian admitted that the new jobs report isn't ideal, but went on to attribute it to various anomalous factors, including data quirks and reduced immigration. Someone should ask Merian why immigration is down. And this afternoon, Trump posted a rant on Truth Social, including the BLS commissioner of cooking the books, to make him look bad. "I have directed my team to fire this Biden political appointee immediately," he wrote. "She will be replaced with someone much more competent and qualified." He then went on to argue, not for the first time, that Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell should be fired for hamstringing the economy with high interest rates. These defenses are, of course, mutually exclusive. If the bad numbers are fake, why should Trump be mad at Powell? If these confuse denials, one detects the shade of desperation on Trump's part. Of course, everything could end up being fine. Maybe economists will be wrong and the economy will rebound with newfound strength in the second half of the year. But that's looking like a far worse bet than it did just 24 hours ago. The next article this week comes from MarketWatch. "Trump and the dollar are doing something we saw just before the October 87 stock market crash. The current political environment and currency market disruption are disturbingly similar." This past week has been strong for the U.S. dollar index, its best since of October of 22. In fact, it's a far cry from the first half of the year when the index lost almost 11%, the worst first half return on record since the index was created in the early 1970s. Looking back, you might think that the weak dollar was good for U.S. stocks, given the S&P 500's total return of 6.2% during this recent period of dollar decline. But the U.S. stock market has also performed spectacularly in years when the dollar was unusually strong, so maybe the dollar's movements don't matter to dollar-based investors. Or just maybe, if the Federal Reserve lowers U.S. interest rates aggressively, as the Trump administration wants, and the dollar declines sharply as a result, the stock market could react adversely. It's happened before, in October of 1987. To gain more insight, I first measured the dollar index's track record as both a coincident and its leading indicator of the S&P 500's earnings per share. I came up mostly empty when investigating the dollar's potential as a coincident indicator. As measured by a statistic known as R-squared, trailing year changes in the dollar index since 1973 have been able to explain or predict just 1% of contemporaneous changes in the S&P 500's earnings per share. A reason for this near zero R-squared is that the relationship between trailing year averages in the dollar and EPS has varied widely. Depending on the five-year period since 1973, the correlation between the two is high as 0.44 or as low as a minus 0.83. What about the dollar as a leading indicator? I next look to see if the dollar's trailing year rate of change is correlated with EPS's subsequent growth rate, but I reached a similar conclusion as before. Take a look at the chart below. It plots the correlation between the dollar's trailing 12-month change and the subsequent 12-month growth rate of the S&P 500. Notice that the correlation is not stable. In the mid-1990s, and again in the period leading up to the 2008 global financial crisis, the correlation was strongly positive, meaning that a stronger dollar led to faster EPS growth. In contrast, the correlation was strongly negative in the 1980s and the early aughts. Over the entire period since the early 1970s, DXY's trailing 12-month changes were able to explain just 0.4% of the subsequent 12-month growth rates on the S&P 500. The question is, did a declining dollar cause the 1987 stock market crash? In both cases, there does not appear to be a statistical basis for concluding that a falling dollar will be either good or bad for dollar-denominated investors. Our next article comes from Fast Company magazine. Nation's top supplier, the housing market pain is worse than builders say. New construction is a bit worse than public home builders are letting on, says Builders First Source CEO Peter Jackson. Builders First Source, the largest U.S. supplier of building materials and prefabricated components, is valued at $14 billion. Given that it takes orders and makes deliveries to builders across the nation, few firms have a more comprehensive view of both multifamily and single-family construction. That's why it's notable that Builders First Source CEO Peter Jackson went out of his way on Thursday to suggest to Wall Street analysts that commentary coming from giant publicly traded home builders this earnings season was underplaying softening and softness in residential construction. There were a lot of public home builders that have released earnings over the past couple of weeks that have reported relatively more positive pictures versus kind of our signal here that it's a bit worse than what people are thinking, Jackson told analysts on the company's July 31st earnings call. Jackson added, given the inventory environment and what we're seeing in terms of the land market, what we're hearing about the takedowns and the contracts, our sense is builders are slowing on the start side. Our sense is that slowing, that's resetting to a lower housing starts rate in order to manage those completed home inventory levels. That's what's going to flow through. So that's the slowing indication that you've got from us. This weaker housing demand environment has caused unsold completed inventory, in particular in the Sun Belt, to tick up. Indeed, since the pandemic housing boom fizzled out, the numbers of unsold completed U.S. new single-family homes has been rising. The June figure is at its highest level since July of 2009. To put the number of unsold completed new single-family homes into historic context, we have Resi Club's Finished Home Survey Supply Index. The index is one simple calculation, the number of unsold completed U.S. new single-family homes divided by the annualized rate of U.S. single-family home starts. A higher index score indicates a softer national new construction market with greater supply slack, while a lower index score signifies a tighter new construction market with less supply. If you're looking at unsold completed single-family new builds as a share of single-family housing starts, it still shows we've gained slack slash single-family construction demand is softening. However, it puts us closer to pre-pandemic 2019 levels than the great financial crisis bust. That said, if new construction or the economy hit a big speed bump and the housing market starts dropped by 20 to 30%, this ratio would spike quickly, even if unsold builds didn't increase much. Much of the completed unsold single-family new builds is located in pockets of the Sun Belt, in states like Florida, Texas, Arizona, Colorado, and Tennessee. According to Resi Club's statistical analysis, there is a modest to moderate correlation between recent single-family permitting levels and active inventory rising above pre-pandemic 2019 levels. In other words, many of the places where single-family home builders have had the strongest presence are also the housing markets that have experienced the greatest recent softening. If you talk to builders in Cleveland, Boston, or New Haven, you're likely to hear a very different story right now from their peers in Tampa, Austin, and San Antonio. Sticking with Fast Company magazine, let's learn about the cult brand chicken chain that's gaining on Chick-fil-A. There are some brands that customers patronize for convenience and some that they frequent out of fandom. Raising Cane's has managed to be both practical and beloved, a potent combo that has fueled the chicken chain's impressive growth. The privately held company posted sales of $5.1 billion in 2024, up 33% from a year earlier, with same-store sales climbing 15%. I asked co-CEO A.J. Kumaran, who joined Raising Cane's in 2014, to explain why people's queue up for the restaurant's relatively limited menu of chicken fingers, crinkle fries, Texas toast, cane sauce, and slaw. He attributes much of the brand's cult-like following to its focus on community. "We don't just serve food, we serve our neighborhood," he explains. "And that's not just corporate speak, that's truly what we believe in." While other restaurant chains might festoon their locations with sports memorabilia from a big league team, a Cowboys flag in Dallas, a Royals hat in Kansas City, Cane's takes a different approach. Each restaurant's decor is assembled by a team that researches and acquires items specific to that community, like a local high school's football jersey, patches, and helmets from the fire department, and even the cover of a hometown musician's latest album. The grand opening of a restaurant in Fall River, Massachusetts this week will feature iced coffee from locally owned New York Babel Company and music from Mason Bronco, the TikTok star and DJ raised in the town. The result is a place that feels like a neighborhood joint. Kumaran says customers typically visit 2 to 3 times a month with the revenue of a national sales chain. Raising Cane's says its average unit volume, an industry metric that represents average sales per restaurant, is $6.6 million, second only to rival cult brand Chick-fil-A, which reportedly boasts $7.5 million across all of its domestic locations. That local feel extends to the structure of the company. Small clusters of restaurants have their own directors of marketing, training, recruiting, employee relations, and operations with facilities based in the area. "We don't have a corporate office. We have a support office," he says. "Within this company of 950 restaurants, we're running about 200 to 250 small companies." Raising Cane's also requires its restaurant leaders to live in the communities where they work. Coincidentally, Chick-fil-A operators are expected to do the same. "We want to scale, but also stay cool." The challenge for Raising Cane's, which was started in 1996 by founder and owner Todd Graves, is to maintain its cult brand status as it expands. The company, which owns and operates almost all of its nearly 1,000 restaurants, aspires to reach $10 billion in sales, with average unit volumes of $8 million by the end of the decade. Still, scale and fandom don't have to be at odds with each other. Grocery chain Trader Joe's, so beloved that customers camped out to buy its shopping bags, reportedly has annual sales of about $17 billion. Luxury fashion house Hermès, one of the most obsessed over brands in the world, last year reported more than $16 billion in revenue. And building community isn't just for consumer brands. 2 years ago, I attended a user conference hosted by HubSpot, the maker of marketing, sales, and customer service software, and saw how the company fostered a sense of kinship through meetups and dedicated space for Black and Latino customers. I'll be watching to see if Canva, the design software company, can maintain its earnest DIY vibe as it expands from the consumer space into serving enterprise customers. As co-CEO Kumaran says, he feels the need to earn his customers' loyalty with every single meal. "It's not easy," he says. "It takes a relentless amount of effort, hard work, focus, and energy." Our next article comes from Entrepreneur Magazine, and the title is "The Financial Truth No One Tells You in Your First 2 Years of Entrepreneurship." When I first started my business, I approached budgeting with the optimism of someone who hadn't yet been burned. I treated it like a tidy math problem. Plug in a few cost estimates, apply a sensible cushion, and the numbers would hold. At least they did in the spreadsheet. What I didn't realize at the time was that business finances aren't as predictable as most people would like. They don't follow rules the way spreadsheet pretend that they do, and they behave more like the weather, being hard to predict, full of surprises, and capable of swinging dramatically based on a single shift in direction. That realization came slowly, usually through trial by fire. Of all the financial lessons I've learned since those early days, two continue to shape the way I run my business. They sound simple, but they have fundamentally changed the way I think about spending, saving, and planning. Lesson one, expect everything to cost twice as much and take twice as long. Everything? Yes, especially in those early years. Not in a pessimistic or dramatic way, but in a realistic one. If there's one thing I've seen consistently, both in my business and in conversations with other founders, is that things always take longer and cost more than you think they will. Maybe it's that contractor who takes 6 weeks instead of 3. Maybe it's the tech stocks that need five additional integrations to work properly. Maybe it's the time cost of revisiting a project because you made a rushed decision up front. You're not necessarily budgeting poorly, you just don't know what you don't know. In those early days, business finances are at their most unpredictable, and there are almost always invisible costs in execution that you can't see in the planning stage. You're still learning. Your systems are fragile. Your vendors and team might still be new. You don't have reliable baselines, and you haven't yet built the muscle memory to forecast with any accuracy. Eventually, this levels out. The business becomes more predictable, and you find better partners. And frankly, you get better at managing finances. But in those early years, invisible costs lurk everywhere. Training time, review cycles that drag, vendor misalignment, tech hiccups, unexpected fees. The little things you forget to add as a line item or just don't know yet can really add up. Now when I forecast expenses, I don't add a generic buffer. I build in a true margin of safety. We run multiple scenarios, best case, expected case, and worst case. For any major investment, I ask, what happens if this costs twice as much and takes twice as long? Do we still want to do it? Sophisticated planning means pressure testing not just the numbers, but the assumptions underneath them. If the ROI still holds under stress, we move forward. If it doesn't, we either adjust scope or we wait. The goal isn't to predict the future perfectly. It's to avoid being surprised by the entirely predictable. The second lesson is that you don't save money if you just spend it somewhere else. I used to think I was being financially savvy when I negotiated better deals, swapped tools, or cut recurring costs. And to be clear, those are good habits. But I had a blind spot. Every time I saved money, I spent it just as quickly elsewhere. At the time, I'd get real satisfaction from trimming costs. Found a cheaper software? Win. Promoted from within instead of hiring externally? Win. Swapped out a tool, renegotiated a rate, or cut an unnecessary subscription? All wins. And then I'd take those savings and, without realizing it, spend them on something else. Sometimes that new margin went to a branding update, sometimes to a software platform we truly didn't need. Other times it disappeared into the ambiguous category of miscellaneous expenses. Things that just felt justified in the moment but didn't move the business forward in any measurable way. I told myself that those costs were inconsequential. After all, we've just saved the money elsewhere, right? But I didn't realize I was chasing efficiency while perpetuating waste. The problem wasn't that I was spending it. It was that I wasn't using those savings intentionally to fuel growth where it actually mattered. Now, when we save money on something, I don't reallocate it reflexively. Instead, we treat the margin as strategic capital, money that can be redeployed, but only if it directly supports our growth goals and operational efficiencies. Sometimes it sits for a quarter. Sometimes it gets earmarked for a high leverage initiative we've already prioritized. Either way, that discipline gives us space to invest with intention, not impulse, and ensures that savings actually create value, not just movement. The shift created financial discipline, not just breathing room. More importantly, it gave us better visibility into which investments were truly driving growth versus which ones were just reactive gap fillers that felt urgent in the moment but didn't move the business forward. What these lessons protect you from? Well, first, it's tempting to treat finances like a back office function, something to review monthly or quarterly, but your financial habits are often the clearest reflection of your leadership. Do you act with discipline or impulsiveness? Do you chase savings without a strategy? Do you overcommit and underprepare? These are patterns, and they compound quietly. Handled well, they create stability and space to grow. Handled poorly, they chip away at your margins, your options, and your confidence. If your current habits aren't moving you in the right direction, course correct it now before the consequences become permanent. Sure, there will always be months where it feels like the money comes in and flows right back out. That's part of the reality of entrepreneurship. But the more you can build financial awareness into your leadership muscle, and the less chaotic those moments will feel. So if you're looking for a place to start, double your cost estimates, be intentional with your savings, and treat every financial decision like it matters. Our next article is also from Entrepreneur, and the title is, Here's What Happened When Thousands of Workers Tried a 4-Day Work Week in the Biggest Trial Yet. A new study shows that workers on a 4-Day Work Week report being happier and more productive. The largest trial ever conducted of a 4-day work week found that the schedule had a positive and noticeable impact on employee well-being. The global study was published on Monday in the journal Nature Human Behavior and led by a Boston College researchers Wen Fan and Juliet Shore. The researchers found that four-day work weeks where employees work 32 hours a week instead of the traditional 40 hours with no reduction in pay markedly improved employee health. Workers reported feeling happier, healthier, and higher performing. For example, nearly 70% of employees reported less burnout, over 40% said that their mental health improved, and 38% experienced better sleep. Beyond maintaining productivity, people just feel so much better, Shore told CNBC about the study findings on Thursday. They feel on top of their work and their life, and they're not stressed out. The researchers followed 2,896 employees on a four-day work week for 6 months, spanning 141 companies in the U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, Ireland, and New Zealand. A control group of 300 employees on a standard five-day work week was used to compare. 2 weeks before the four-day work week began, employees were asked questions like, how would you rate your mental health? And then they were asked again after 6 months after the four-day work week schedule. The control group was asked the same questions in the same time frame without having the shorter work week. Fan, an associate professor of sociology at Boston College, was initially worried that worker well-being would worsen because employees would feel pressure to be more productive on a schedule with a reduced number of days. But the findings showed that worker stress levels actually fell. After 6 months, employees working 4 days a week instead of five reported an improved ability to complete their work and decrease fatigue. The control group, meanwhile, did not report any significant changes. The results indicate that income-preserving four-day work weeks are an effective organizational intervention for enhancing workers' well-being, the researchers wrote in the study. Companies are opting to stick to the four-day work week once they try it. The researchers stated that over 90% of the companies in the experiment kept the four-day work week after the six-month trial period. Shore wrote in the Wall Street Journal last month that on the employer side, organizations that piloted a four-day work week found it noticeably improved their bottom line, with revenue increasing and resignations decreasing. Over 245 global businesses and nonprofit organizations have trialed a four-day work week over the past 3 years, reaching 8,700 employees around the world, Shore noted. One major company that utilizes the four-day work week is crowdfunding platform Kickstarter, which started its shortened work week as a pilot program in 2021. Kickstarter CEO Everett Taylor told investor Kevin O'Leary last year that employees are very productive within the four-day structure. I love the fact that people at our company have other interests, Taylor said. And our final article for this week's episode comes from Bloomberg Businessweek. The title is What the Tough Job Market for New College Grads Says About the Economy. It's been a long time since the dream of working your way up from the mailroom to the corner office was a plausible outcome, but it might now be officially dead. Some of the reasons are obvious. For one, the internet long ago made the mailroom almost obsolete. But as new college graduates have headed out into the job market this summer, they're reporting a different problem. They can't get a foot in the door at all. Landing that first job is trickier right now in some fields than others, but even in sectors with low unemployment, new entrants to the white-collar labor market describe a far steeper climb than they'd anticipated. The unemployment rate for recent grads sat at 5.8 in March, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, more than twice that for all degree holders and 50% higher than in the spring of 22. This much, at least, everyone agrees on. Exactly how worrying this trend is and what's to blame are the subject of far greater confusion. According to an analysis of BLS data by Ernie Tesco, director of economics at the Budget Lab at Yale University, hiring rates for new grads are down from their post-pandemic highs, but they're still in line with the latter half of the 2010s. And in population-level numbers, things in the labor market still look placid. We still see low unemployment, and we do see pretty solid job gains, said Allison Shervasta, an economist at the hiring platform Indeed. Young adults are getting spat out into a job market that isn't nearly as bad as, say, that of the Great Recession, but also isn't as lush as it was in the recent past when they might have watched older friends and siblings get snapped up before graduation. Being in that position would certainly feel terrible, although the long arc of a professional life, it could be worse. Yet those numbers don't tell the full picture. A lot of those job gains are in the healthcare industry, driven by things such as the rising demand for mental health services and an aging population. The healthcare industry alone can't float a labor market. If you're not a newly minted doctor or nurse, you're probably at least a little bit worse off than your slightly older peers. If you're looking for a tech job, you might be much worse off. According to an analysis by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, graduates in computer science, computer engineering, and graphic design all have unemployment rates of almost 7% or greater. Young workers who hold a number of much maligned humanities degrees, including English, history, and philosophy, are all more hireable. The dip in hiring for those with tech degrees, which have long been sold to college students as a sure thing, has elicited fears that AI may have started to upend the labor market. Nathan Goldschlag, director of research at the Economic Innovation Group, a bipartisan think tank, has been looking into AI's effect on hiring, and he doubts that the technology's impact has been significant enough to explain the situation. It does look like there is some there, but it's not something that jumps off the page, he says. For one, the effect doesn't show up consistently for sectors outside tech. The new grad unemployment rate, he says, is low for things like accounting and business analytics, which are two things that when you're coming from the AI space, you're like, oh, well, those are ripe for automation. Some non-tech companies may be experimenting with having AI do tasks that normally fall to entry-level workers, but Goldschlag doesn't think AI is the root cause of the current stagnation. Shirvasaka sees something similar. These sectors are just down. They're not hiring, she says, pointing to an additional factor that she'd notice in Indeed's data. Internship listings have meaningfully decreased, which is an early warning sign that the hiring rates for entry-level workers continues to soften. Many starter roles for white-collar work doesn't come from job listings, but from interns being given return offers. If you want to account for the decline of that kind of hiring, internship listings are a useful proxy. To explain this more fully, Goldschlag points to a larger term trend in the college wage premium, which is the difference in expected earnings for someone with a degree relative to someone without. It's been falling since 2012, which to him suggests that the U.S. might be overproducing college-educated workers relative to demand.